All right. This isn't easy. Okay? The battle of the mind is the biggest problem. Okay? The battlefield of the mind. And that's what you see playing out in Numbers. Actually, that's what you see in the garden with Chava and the serpent and Adam. It's a battlefield of the mind. And it's the flesh wins, it goes badly. The spirit wins, it goes well. And so when we give in to the flesh, see, I know a lot of people still think of the flesh as being what we might consider in our social circles worldly behavior. Anything that goes against Torah is flesh. Anything that's in line with Torah's spirit. Makes it real simple. Hopefully we can embrace this. All right, this is what we call the afterburn. So if you're online, Kurt's going to be monitoring for comments and questions. So go ahead and get those typed in. And if you have anybody here that wants to say anything, you can raise your hand and we'll have you come up to the microphone. All right, Steve, go ahead.
All right, I just had a little comment regarding chapter 14 Numbers. And this is just kind of goes in line with what you said in the beginning, I think. Let me see if I can read my own writing. Isn't this how many people have reacted here? People come here to find only something to complain about. And when it's not changed to their liking, they leave. What we fail to notice is the problem we had follows us, because in most cases, the problem was ourselves. And then, I wanted to add another thought came later on as you were talking, is we all don't like something, but what says we're going to like everything Yeshua has to say? We can't even receive what we're getting from our manly leadership. How are we going to receive what he has to tell us?
Amen. And I appreciate you calling me manly. Okay, so... I know what he meant. When you can't listen to a man speaking. Some of you are thinking, oh, Rabbi, why are you? Okay. Sarah Beth, come on up. But you're right. I mean, if you can't listen to a human, they couldn't listen to Moses. How are they going to listen to Yahweh? Go ahead.
Question. Hopefully you can understand what I'm trying to say.
Now you sound like me. You took the deep breath and went, I hope this is going to make sense. Okay.
No higher compliment than to sound like you. Okay. You said earlier in the teaching that to trust the leadership, to follow that leadership, it's on them if they make a mistake. We don't have to worry about following a leader that's sinning. You know, we're sinning. For clarification, I think I've heard you clarify it before, but for clarification, when is that black and white? Yeah, like the calendar is just gray, just follow already, but where is that point where, because we are responsible, we can't just follow off the cliff. Like if you said it was okay to eat pork.
No, obviously not. Look, first of all, I think I made this clear, but we'll make it clearer. You're not just going to follow all leadership. You're going to go find yourself leadership that you can submit under. Okay. Now, if that leadership loses its mind, well, then the cloud has moved and you may have to go somewhere else. Okay. But you know, first you're going to seek clarification, because I can't tell you how many times, well, I can only tell you that how many times people have come to me and I know that they didn't understand what I said. I can't tell you how many times people had the same problem and didn't come to me for clarification, only to find out that I didn't say anything close to what they thought I said. Okay? They just heard something, misunderstood it, jumped to a wrong conclusion, thought I was teaching against something that they believed was important, or taught for something they thought was wrong, only to find out that was not the case at all. So first thing you do is you go ahead and check with the leadership to make sure that they're actually encouraging or endorsing something that you thought they were before you think it's wrong, because you may not have heard it right. Or in the, this is the tough part, you're in front of a microphone, you say everything as fast as you do over, you know, 70 minutes, and then you can easily come across with the tripping over your tongue and say something that you could see was interpreted not the way you meant it. If you've ever had any conversation with anybody, you know that having them hear and receive what you said the way you meant it is a brutally impossible thing, okay? And so you first want to seek to understand by going and saying, look, this is what I thought you said. Could you clarify? And then I go, whoa, that's not what I said. or that's not what I meant. Now, that's good. Now, if I say, well, absolutely, that's what, and you think that, then you may have to go somewhere else. And you can, and you'll have to choose what those issues are that are where you draw the line. Okay? Now, if it's an issue over something in the halakha that's your obsession, that may not be the place you need to draw the line just because you happen to be obsessed, which could be anything from, you know, the calendar to the nature of the Godhead to head coverings to seats. It could be anything. But if it's your obsession, you know, then at least go to, I've seen people do this. They have an obsession and then they go to another place where the thing they're obsessed about is still not being done. So I'm like, why'd you go there? I mean, if it's your obsession, why would you go someplace where they're not doing the thing you're obsessed about if that was the reason you left where you left? I mean, I throw up my hands and go, okay, I don't get it. All right? But that's the whole thing is if it's your, I hate to use the word obsession or pet thing, but if it's your thing that's important to you, I'm not saying that doesn't make it important, but you are more emotionally invested, which makes you more susceptible to making a overreact or a knee-jerk reaction to something, okay? That doesn't mean that you are going to only make a wrong reaction, but you're more susceptible because of the level of emotional investment in that particular issue, okay? And that's what you want to be careful of and ask yourself, am I emotionally invested in this issue? Two things happen when you're emotionally invested. One is you're going to be more likely to be offended if somebody is not online with, in line, you know, with whatever it is you're emotionally invested with. The other is that if you happen to be wrong, you will have a real hard time receiving different information to kind of get you to think a different way where you can consider a different possibility. I don't mean to get you to think, but are you open to considering that you could be wrong? So when you have that kind of emotional investment, you're very much, like it's like when I used to get involved years ago, people kind of dragged me into some of these calendar fights. And then it was my turn to speak. After watching the two guys fight with each other, I say, look, did you not all see what just happened? There isn't a prayer in you know what that either one had any shot at convincing the other one. They were too emotionally invested. Neither one listened to anything the other one had to say. They each made their case, but nobody was listening. Because nobody was open to the possibility. Because they already had resolved in their own minds. And it was because of an emotional level of investment in that particular thought. Because after all, after making, this is another reason why you need to just calm down out there in public about your emotionally invested things. Because if you ever want to change your mind, now it's really hard to do it because you know you publicly just killed everybody about it. And now you're going to look stupid, and rightly so, when you change your position. Not stupid for changing your position, but stupid for making such a big deal about it and then changing your position. I personally know a guy who was a leader and still is a leader of a congregation who absolutely was annihilating all of the Lunar Sabbath people until he became one. But publicly mocked them, ridiculed them, and then he became one. Okay? And then he mocked all these other things until he decided that was wrong and then he went Enochian. And I'm just saying is that but then everybody looks at you like, you look foolish. You really look foolish. Okay? So be careful of how public you are with your emotionally invested thing. Because now you've really made it impossible to change. Because you're kind of all in. And then you get all kinds of mud on your face type of thing and, you know, whatever. Okay? That's where I want you to be careful. Be careful of having to get in everybody's face about your thing. Look, I used to play this game. I think it's a great game to play. I do it usually when it's a big crowd, like I'm guest speaking someplace. I call it have you ever been wrong game, you know? And I go, have you ever been wrong? Everybody raises their hand, of course. All right. And then when you were wrong, was it ever about something that, you know, because people are just wrong sometimes, you make a mistake. All right. I mean, I thought I was wrong once, but I made a mistake. Anyway, so, but sometimes I wanted to know when you were wrong, have you ever been wrong, but you just, I mean, but you knew. You were willing to bet the house and bet your marriage and bet, whatever. I mean, you knew, and you still were wrong. Hands all go up. Any chance that'll happen again in the future? Hands all go up. Now, when you were wrong and you were so sure, there was no way you could see it coming that you were going to be wrong, right? Okay, all hands go up. Which means that if it's going to happen again in the future, it's going to be something that you don't see coming. There's no way you'd expect to be wrong. So why would you be so in everybody's face about these things, knowing that, wasn't it fun the last time? Usually it's with a spouse. That's the best, right? Oh, you're in your wife's face or you're in your husband's face, only to find out eventually you were wrong. And now you got to sit there and kind of eat your hat, so to speak, or whatever it is, whatever metaphor you like to use, idiomatic phrase. It's embarrassing. And then you get all kind of dig your heels in because you know you're wrong now, but now you don't know what to do because you're embarrassed. We need to calm down about our stuff because we got to know. That goes back to what Steve said, which is Yeshua's going to come. And when he comes, I promise you at least one thing he's going to say, and you're going to be like, what? No. I was convinced it was the other way. Can we agree that that's going to happen? Well, then why are we so just brutal on each other about these things we get so emotional about? You've been wrong before. You're going to be wrong again. And you're going to be wrong absolutely in an area you didn't see coming. You've been there before. And if you're not a raging egomaniac, you know it's going to happen again. So stop being a raging egomaniac in everybody's face and telling everybody how dumb they are and how right you are, you know, and making such an issue out of it. This is, you know, it's like the guys who used to come up to me screaming at me when I would guest speak someplace because I didn't have a beard. I mean, like, they were, like, angry. But they didn't have tzitzit on either. I did. And I'm like, you're so obsessed on this one thing, you're not seeing anything else. Okay, I don't have a beard. Well, you don't have tzitzit on. So, okay, so neither one of us is perfect in whatever way you're thinking of it. Of course, you know my point about the beard anyway. I wear one now because I'm tired of arguing. All right? Really, I mean, I hate shaving anyway, but I mean, I just really got tired of the argument. So you're not supposed to cause your brother to stumble. So I wear a beard. It causes less people to stumble. Because they'll trip up because they're so emotionally invested. That's the problem is the flesh mind of Romans 8 is emotionally invested in flesh concepts. Oh, they're not flesh concepts, Rabbi. I'm trying to figure out Torah. Okay, well, take a few years to learn. I mean, you know, you've been doing this 5 minutes and now you think you figured it all out. I can't tell you how often a person is like out of the church, into this, and they've already figured out the whole calendar perfectly themselves in like 2 years. They've got it. They figured it out. They understand all these things so well. And if you ever sat down to talk to me, I'd be very happy to show you at least three things that you didn't even take into consideration when you figured out your calendar. I mean, do you know what crops harvest when? Do you know what time of year things happen? Do you know that Deuteronomy says that when you finish your threshing and your wine pressing, go keep Sukkot? Do you know? I mean, there's a lot of things people don't take into account where they think they figured out their calendar. So this is the humility that's necessary, you know? And that's where it gets really challenging. All right, you ready, Kurt? All right, go for it.
All right, let's see. Livia and Janet Hoffman, Rabbi, Numbers chapter 14, verse 2. When people say something negative about leadership without necessarily wanting to change the leadership, I divert it. How should I respond to those situations?
Look, you know, if somebody's coming to you with negative about leadership, I taught this, you know, last week or the week before. I said, look, first of all, you say, have you dealt with the leadership? And if they don't want to do that, then you say, well, then there's nothing more for us to discuss. Okay? Because why do you need to be involved in that? Oh, but they're my friend. Well, I don't know. Is that really what your friend needs, is for you to be there as a way for them to attack leadership so they can vent? You need to vent? Tell them go on your knees and vent. You're always very patient. You can vent all you want. But otherwise, you may be negatively influencing somebody because of your emotional challenge at the moment about whatever it is you're upset about. Because you're responding in a strong emotion. It's like I've told all of you guys, you know, and this is not a law, this is not a mandate, but I was like, it is absolutely just ludicrous and foolish to post anything on any social media when you're in a strong negative emotional place. Because you will say stuff you should not say. You need to calm down before you post, and probably if you calm down, you won't post. or it'll look very different once you're calmed down. Well, the same thing when you're upset with leadership. If you're going to talk to anybody about it, talk to your spouse if you have a spouse. If you have a best friend, you could talk to that friend. But you know what? Most best friends, their default is just to join your side and gang up on whatever it is that you're agree with you and gang up on the other person. So that really doesn't also help even anyway. The only way that you're going to get any satisfaction in what you're really dealing with is to go to the person you have a problem with. That's why scripture tells you, I don't know, go to the person you have a problem with. Otherwise, you know, going to your friend isn't going to help anything. It may make you feel a little better because now you feel like you're justified. They're going to tell you that you're right and the other person's wrong. And by the way, if you're the friend and the person's coming to you with the negative stuff and you have no personal firsthand experience with whatever they're talking about, shame on you for believing and buying into everything they say. Oh, well, my friend wouldn't lie to me. Your friend wouldn't, in an emotional place, see things through a filter that maybe skews things just a little bit. Okay, let's play a new game. Have you ever been in an emotional place where you totally skewed and filtered what happened to a place that it turns out you were completely wrong, but in your emotions you saw it the way you saw it? Come on. They really did feel the way they felt, and that's why they're telling you what they felt, but that doesn't mean they're telling you exactly what happened correctly. Okay, I'm telling you, I had a man sitting 8 feet from me at another desk on a phone with somebody who went on Facebook and said I screamed at them, and I never, see, this would be considered screaming. I didn't talk louder than this in the phone call the whole time with a witness. But to them, I yelled at them. Now, good thing I had a witness sitting there. I never was louder than this. But they didn't like what I said. So they accused me of yelling at them. Might even have said screaming at them. Now, if you were the one hearing that conversation, what would you think? You would have pictured that I must have been screaming at them. But I had a witness sitting next to me. Actually, Manny was in the next room. Okay, he's at the door. Did I raise my voice at all? No. Okay. But the person then posted, I yelled at them. Just remember, in their emotional state, reality is being messed with. I don't know, there's a word for what I'm looking for, but I mean, it's not accurate anymore. The perception of reality is not accurate. I don't say reality is not accurate. You're no longer, through the emotional filters, able to accurately process what happened. Two things tend to happen, by the way. I'm going to give you a little psychology lesson, right? Two things tend to happen, especially because the Hoffmans asked the question, so Janet will appreciate this. All right? One thing that happens is you tend to perceive things that didn't actually happen, bigger, different, smaller, whatever, in a negative way, whatever it is. You're picturing it wrong. The second thing that happens when you're in that space is that your time flow gets out of joint. And so now you don't remember things in the right order. How many times have you been in an argument with your spouse, those of you that are married, and from the moment that whatever it is that you said to her, or whichever one I'm talking about, I'm going to deal with the men. Like you said, as soon as you did something that triggered her, she does not remember what she said to trigger you first. That's not her fault. It's part of this emotional problem. All she knows is that you did what you did. Well, you just exploded for no reason. For no reason, but they don't even remember that. Or in their minds, it happened after you exploded because it will affect the order of time in their head. This is not just for the ladies. It's for anybody. I'm just saying, from my experience as a man, I'm just saying is when you have an emotional, you know, negative emotional experience with somebody, you're not going to remember it correctly. Some things are going to be blown out of proportion, bigger or whatever it is that they're supposed to be. By the way, on the positive side, you have the same thing. You're a teenager. You know, whether you're the girl or the guy, and somebody sort of maybe smiled or said something nice, in your head, they were like, just flowing with love for you. I mean, oh, he likes me, she likes me. No, they're just being nice. But in your head, through the filter, it was bigger, it was more, it was whatever, okay? When you're in a strong emotional state, recognize your perception of reality is diminished in terms of accuracy, and your flow of time gets disjointed. Just remember that in the background. So the next time you're in a strong emotional place, positive or negative, you are susceptible to those two problems. All right? No extra charge at Shabbat for that important lesson. You need to know this. So when your friend comes to you and they are crying or angry or fuming or some strong negative emotion, no matter what they tell you, it's going to be out of proportion to some degree and the timeline's going to be a little screwed up. Okay? Remember that when they talk to you. And they will absolutely not remember what they did to trigger it. They won't own that at all because they can't at that point. They're so mad at the other person. So that person just did this? Yep, that's what they did. Come on, tell me you've never had that conversation with anybody. Really? Nothing happened first? Nope. You didn't do anything? Nope. That's a kid talking to their mother too. So that fight you had, so you didn't do anything to your sister? Nope. You didn't do anything to your brother? Nope. Really? Bring the other one down. You find out all the parts that you're missing in that story. This is the flesh world where we are processed with this emotional filtering and we can't process right. When we're in the flesh, when we're in the below mindset, and we're offended and we're upset and we let our feelings bag spill, so somebody stepped on something, you know. So just keep that in mind. It's very important. All right, next.
All right, from Marianne. How do I handle submission to an unbelieving husband?
All right, so there's an abundance of things that have nothing to do with covenant or Torah in your relationship with your husband, so that you need to respect that he's the husband, he's the head. The only problem comes in when you're dealing with a Torah issue, okay? So when it's a Torah issue, every marriage is unique in a lot of its parameters. You need to call or get in touch with us for counsel about those particular issues when they come up on the best way to address them so that you are not usurping or disrespecting your husband, but you're also not dishonoring your Creator. So it's not so simple. I can't just give a simple answer. But recognize that just because he's non-believing the way you do in Torah and covenant and everything else doesn't diminish his role as husband. And so you still have a submission requirement up to a certain point in how it plays out because of that. And when you call us, we will not usurp that either. Okay? No ministry should usurp a husband in a relationship. So if you have that kind of a challenge with your husband, you're free to call us and we can help you walk through the options of how you can handle those things. Okay? Okay, let me say something that I said with the tithing teaching, but it's going to apply to this. Remember in the tithing teaching, I told you that tithing will expose one of two things? Well, guess what? Torah observance in a marriage is going to expose one of two or three things. So it's not just that, well, he doesn't believe in the Torah stuff, he's not covenanted. It's going to show what real relationship you have with your husband. Or if you're the husband and the wife, it'll show what kind of real relationship you have with your wife. Because if you have a proper relationship, you should be able to adjust to almost anything. If you don't, it won't work so well. And so it's not just, well, the Torah is the problem. No, the relationship had these problems already. You just didn't have something to trigger it. It was always underlying in there. Something now has brought it to the surface. This was what brought it out. Now you're going to have to work on your marriage in general, not just worry about, well, but he wants me to go to church and he doesn't want me to keep the Sabbath and he wants me to eat pork. Well, what kind of husband would want you to do that if you don't want to do that? It'd be like saying that, you know, you married your husband and you've been eating meat and everything else and all of a sudden now you want to go vegan and he doesn't want to respect that and wants to force you to eat meat. I mean, it's the same thing. Okay, why? If he can't respect you, then you have a relationship problem. The vehicle for the disrespect is Torah observance. The problem is disrespect. Do you see what I'm talking about? So it's exposing a relationship problem that was already there. Now, maybe it wasn't openly there because there hadn't been anything to bring it to the surface. This is now exposing something that was there. Okay? And the funny thing is, how many husbands or wives will make the unbelievable emotional tirade over this, and they're not even observant in whatever thing they do. It's like they're not even like actively Christian or whatever. I mean, they're but now they're making a big deal. Well, now I want you to come to church with me. Come, you don't even go, you know. Come to church with you. What do you mean? Come to church with you, you know. What I'm just saying is, so whoever wrote that, and anybody else has this kind of question, The unequally yoked situation is always challenging. It's never easy. Some situations have gotten to a place of shalom where they're easier than others. But you have other things that are being exposed. Often it's that your relationship with your spouse is not what you thought it was. Okay? All right, next question.
Pete and Brenda Lamb.
All right. Okay.
Is a lesson to learn from Numbers 14:40 that we should teshuva while we can before it's too late?
Yeah, you want to make the adjustments before Yahweh says you don't get to go in. Oh, that's a great thought. Hold on. Thank you. Okay. You know the verse that you probably always wondered about where it says at the end there'll be those that are lined up outside and weeping and gnashing of teeth? That's them. The ones who now finally realize my way didn't work. And a Christian mindset would be like, well, that doesn't seem right. They should be able to get in because they're sorry now. Nope. He said that when I close the door, I close the door. You should have made the decision when you should have made the decision. So there are going to be those that are weeping and gnashing of teeth, not because they're repentful. It's because they're like these guys who were repentful. Oh, no, I'm ready to do it now. Because now you already told me I'm going to die anyway. Okay? He wants you to do it when you're not under duress. To do it. He wants you to choose to do it. So like when you look in Revelation and it talks about those outside with the weeping and gnashing of teeth or waiting to get in that lake of fire, whatever that is, you know, it's not repentful weeping and gnashing of teeth. It's the reality that what he said would happen is about to happen and you didn't believe him. And now you're reaping what you sowed. It's like the kid who's all mad when you punish them and they throw a fit. Now, they're not mad at themselves. Who are you mad at when you get pulled over for speeding? The cop or yourself? You are not mad at you. Well, yes, you are. You're mad that you weren't paying enough attention to see him before he caught you. But you're not mad that you were speeding. You're mad that he caught you. You're mad that you got distracted. You're mad at the kid maybe because it said something you looked over or a spouse and you took your eyes off of maybe seeing the speed trap for half a second. You're mad at all the things except owning that you were doing, that you deserve that. You are not sitting there saying, you know what, I was speeding, I deserve this ticket. Come on, tell me if I'm, you know I'm telling the truth here. And then you're going to be just like these guys to somebody. You're going to be driving all nice for about 3 miles. Or maybe the rest of that short little distance you're going, but next time you get in that car, you're just going to be looking a little bit more, making look. I'll catch him this time. You didn't learn anything. I own that t-shirt. Okay? You didn't learn anything. But you're mad that you got caught. And then your spouse is going to yell at you for the ticket, and your spouse speeds too. It's like, what are you yelling at me for? You don't keep the speed limit. Yeah, but you got caught. I'm mad at you for getting caught. See, this is the weeping and gnashing of teeth thing. They're not mad at themselves for actually doing the thing. They're upset that the concert, that's what was happening at the end of chapter 14, right? They're realizing, oh, he was serious. Okay, we're going to go now. Well, wait a minute. He just told you not to go. You're going to die. Too late. All right, next question.
All right, so Carolyn asks, so number 14:1, could all mean all those who were rebelling and that he knew who they all were?
Not exactly, because look, remember, the 10 that were really the problem, then it talks about in 13, they started really influencing a lot of people, okay? And so he held responsible only those that were what? Of legal age and were witnesses to the things he had done. Okay? He didn't hold anybody else accountable. 20 and above, that's legal age according to Scripture, and who had been there to witness the things that had happened. Who should know better. Okay? So that would be my answer. So when it says, then all the congregation lift up their voices, it was a lot of people, so it felt like all. But look, I get this all the time. People will come all the time, right? I get people come up to me and say, well, you know, everybody doesn't, no, nobody likes your decision to do this, or everybody wants to do this, so why can't we do that? But I was like, what, did you take a survey? No, the three people they spoke to were in agreement with them. So that's everybody. Well, everybody wants us to do this for Oneg. Everybody wants this. Everybody? You talk to all 100 and whatever people that come here? Well, nobody likes the decision you made to do this. Nobody? Who'd you talk to? Well, people keep coming up to me, you know, everybody, you know, be careful when we globalize, is what I'm trying to say. All right? I'm sorry, go ahead. Well,
to follow up on that, to reinforce, I guess. So basically at chapter 26 says, the carcasses of all that grumbled against me are going to fall in the desert, only Caleb and Yehoshua are going to make it through. So it sounds like at that point you read that and say, well, all grumbled at that particular point.
Well, yeah,
if you go back to verse 22, though, he talks about the 10 times that they have gone against him. So that's all-encompassing.
He reached his level of saying, I'm done with this. But the thing is, he's only holding accountable those who should have accountability. Okay, the 20 and olders. All right, go ahead.
Okay, UC Renegade, Numbers 14:34. Did Yahweh break off with the 10 in leadership only? Obviously, kids were taught proper Torah ways because they went into the land. What is breaking off anyway? Question mark. 14:34.
Well, I mean, look, it's just another way of saying what Moses says to them in verse 42. He says, don't do these things, for Yahweh's not in your midst. That's the idea of breaking off. Okay, like the branch that's broken off. Yeshua talks about that in John, 15. Okay? The breaking off of a branch, the putting outside the camp. It's just another way, an idiomatic phrase for saying, I've cut you off. You do not have me in your midst. You are not protected. You're no longer covered. You're going to die in the wilderness.
Tracy Weimer, question. How are we to respond properly to those that say all those before us were wrong? My parents were wrong, and all the theologians were wrong. Who are you? How old are you? Are we
57? Not yet, actually, almost.
Are we just to walk away?
Look, you know, those are conversations that you shouldn't be in anyway. I mean, those are conversations that will not have any productive results out of. Okay? Look, you can't win those conversations. There's nothing to be gained in those conversations. Just simply say, look, we have had, historically, the book talks about if they're Bible people, if they use the Bible in any way, just read through the Bible. From Genesis all the way through, there have been people that have had the truth and those that have misunderstood it, misrepresented it, and messed it up. And generationally, that has happened, where it says we've inherited lies from our fathers, have inherited lies, and all these other things that we've done. It's scriptural. That's not to say the truth has not been there throughout. There's been the prophets that he sent with the truth, and there's been those individuals that embraced it to whatever degree. But generally speaking, those in the decision-making authority have made wrong decisions based on wrong understandings and wrong interpretations. So, what we have is a challenge. You come out of the church system when you realize that system is wrong and has lies in it, and now you have to, the challenge of what kind of barometer do I use now to find the truth? How do I find the truth? How do I even know? I've been fooled so many times. I'm not qualified. Of course, you have that thought only for a short while till then after, a year or two of this, now you think you're qualified, that you know everything. But you got to be careful with that. Allow him to lead you through a journey till you find what you need to find. Okay? I'll give you an example. I don't know if this is a good example, but I'll give you an example. I was in martial arts for a long time, okay? And I studied a very specific art. I was studying Goju. Goju is an Okinawan art, all right? And it's the same one, believe it or not, in the Karate Kid movie, okay? But that was before there was a Karate Kid movie. I'd been studying it already for a long time. And all the years of study and my exposure, eventually I had my own school. This is in 1987. I had my own school. I was a sensei the whole nine yards. A guy walked into my school, and he said to me, I see you doing Goju. He says, when you want to see it the right way, the real way, let me know. I'm over here down the rock and come over and see me. And I was like, well, the nerve of you. I'm the sensei in this place. Who are you? But I was open to see what he had to say. So I went over to see what he had to say. And then I watched what he was doing. And I had enough years of knowledge to recognize, oh, That's what it's supposed to look like. I had only understood it up to a point. He had much more. Then I came to find his teacher was much more directly in line with the person who had founded the style that we were doing. And so had a much more pure understanding of it. But see, had I seen his thing and my thing within the first couple of years of when I was doing mine, I wouldn't have necessarily noticed any difference or understood the subtleties of what was different. It took years of my understanding of what I was doing to be able to recognize the difference in what he was doing. Does that make any sense as I'm trying to make this analogy? So it takes a while for you to get to that place where you're able to see the difference between what one teacher might be teaching and another teacher might be teaching, because you just, it all seems new and exciting and different and confused and whatever to you when you're brand new. And then when you get your legs under you after a couple of years, you think, oh, well, now it takes a long time to get to that place where you really can see. I mean, there's things that I say and I do. Manny will ask a question. I'll go to answer the question. He'll be like, you make it sound so easy. Well, it's so easy because I've been doing this for a long time, not because it's just so easy. And over the years of having enough questions asked, I can almost always, very quickly, almost instantaneously, know what they're trying to ask, even if they're not using the right words. And so sometimes Manny will read the question and he said, this is what the person asked. And I said, well, I understand that, but this is what they're really asking. And he's like, well, that makes total sense. But he couldn't see it because he doesn't have that much years of experience to see it. And eventually he will, you see? But that takes training and time and all that stuff. So just recognize that when you're new at this, you're going to keep coming to higher levels of discernment where you're going to recognize, oh. And that's why you won't go to certain places, because you'll say, there's no reason to go over there. They're not where I need to go because they're not at the level I need to get to. Because you have been through some stepping stones. There's a couple of ministries people almost always go through before they get to me. And they're stepping stones. And they're good stepping stones. Okay? And maybe there's a place to go after me, and that's fine too, if you find whatever. What I'm just saying is, you understand? But you have to get to that level. And a lot of people that are leaving here, and they come here, like they don't even know what I'm doing. They don't have any understanding of what I'm really offering here. They're not at a level yet to even receive the depth. You go back and listen to some of the teachings you first listened to and see how much you missed because you weren't ready. And this is not about me. I'm not bragging or anything. I'm just simply saying you were not in the same place you are now. Then you will go back and go, how did I miss all of that the last time I heard this 2 years ago? Because you're not in the same place. You've learned so much more. Filters have been removed. Your ability to hear and see and receive is in a completely different place. So don't be like, oh, yeah, I listened to that teaching. Yeah, but when was it? Okay, if it was 3 years ago, 5 years ago, it will not be the same. Go back and listen to it. You'll be like, wow. It's like hearing it for the first time. Because you're in a different place. So hopefully that makes some sense. Go ahead.
All right, Olivia and Janet Hoffman. Rabbi, there is people who tend to grumble and complain, perhaps as a habit and faulty mindset, especially addressed people, and are truly not able to switch this thinking and habit. Any suggestions?
All right, well, first thing is the word habit that you mentioned. Okay, so Janet, look, you have to get the person to recognize that this is a habitual behavior. Thinking is still a behavior, okay? And so once you recognize it's something that's a habit and not an actual response to something that's a legitimate response, but it's a default habit, then you can address it like you'd address any habit. I mean, a habit like smoking, a habit like anger, any kind of thing that's a habitual behavior or a habitual response, you know? Just like the kid who automatically sticks its finger in its mouth when they're little, you have to break them of a habit. First, you have to make them aware of it, and then come up with tools to bring that awareness to the point where they now have strategies to stop when they start. But you have to first recognize it, and the faster you can recognize it, the faster you can address it. Okay? And there's lots of tools for that, Janet, that we've talked about, so I'm sure you have plenty for that. But just focus on the word habit. Okay, stinking thinking, if it's habitual, that was a little tribute to Zig right there. Okay, but stinking thinking, if it's habitual, has to be addressed like any other habit. Breaking habits, there are lots of little protocols at work. Use one that works on a mindset problem, and you can break that. I don't have time to get into them here, but Janet knows. Okay.
All right. Helen Thrasher, how can we work on overcoming the fear of the unknown and how to trust it? And what does that look like?
Okay. This is going to sound really too obviously simple. How do you address the fear of the unknown? By embracing the known. Problem is, what if you don't actually have a relationship with what you informationally know? What was the problem in Numbers 13 and 14? They didn't embrace the knowing of Yah, so they were afraid of the unknown of what was going to happen in the land. The more you embrace the known, the less you have work. Look, if you are in a proper relationship, I'll use my daughter and I for example. As a daughter, she trusts me fully because in her life, I've always been there to make sure that I'm the hero, I'm the safe place, everything. So that knowing makes her not afraid as much of unknown stuff because she has a knowing. You see what I'm saying? When you first get married, that could be a challenge with your spouse because especially ladies, you marry a man and now he's your husband, but you know him, but do you really know him? Can you trust him? Well, you know, because he got all these unknowns. Well, the more you know that person, the less you have to worry about unknowns. So focus on the knowns, and then you won't have to worry as much about the unknowns, okay? But Daddy, this is scary. Yeah, but I'm here. You're okay. Okay, then I don't have to worry about it anymore. That's the same thing with our Creator. Father, I'm afraid. Yeah, but he got me, so you don't have to be afraid. Oh, I forgot about that. Okay, good. Now I'm not afraid anymore. You see, how well do you know him? You know, I did a teaching called, Do You Know the Father and the Son? It wasn't just about the information about their relationship, but if you know, then you won't have those fears. Okay? So that's how we address the fear of the unknown. Focus on the known. Go ahead, next.
Right, this question is from Ati. Is it okay if I'm working towards being aligned with the Spirit, in parentheses mindset, but find myself messing up? Example, I struggle with this in my workplace. I think I beat myself up too much anytime I screw up.
Okay. So let's address the real problem is the beating yourself up part. Because the other part sounds like you've got it pretty much under control. You try to align with it. You know that you mess up. That's all of us. The problem is what happens when you catch yourself messing up, especially if it happens over and over and over again, you start to feel defeated. You beat yourself up. You feel like you're not worthy. You feel like you're a failure and all these other things. That's the thing that you want to get some counsel about so that you can address that psychological and emotional challenge where you have a defeated. Now, it could be because you had somebody in your life telling you, you can't do it, you're a failure, you'll never amount to anything. People have fed that to you in your life. Okay, most people, by the time they get to be like a 17 or 18 year old, have had lots and lots of people, and I tell them what they can't do and how they'll never amount to anything and how they'll never get anywhere and all this other stuff. Everybody has that in their life. Now, how you responded to it is how much it affected you or not. Some people, they responded to it like, well, I'll show you, and they didn't, and so it didn't affect them in a bad way. Other people, they're so ready to believe those voices as soon as they struggle, saying, see, they always told me I was no good, that I could never do this, I'm a failure. Well, let's deal with the known and the unknown. What's the known? Yahweh says you're going to struggle, that all fall short. Yahweh also said, if I call you, that you can get there from where you are. So then why beat yourself up? Don't beat yourself up. Brush yourself off and get up and start again. Why beat yourself up? Own it. That doesn't mean beat yourself up. Do the, fix it, repent, recommit, start again. Own it, repent, start again. Just repeat and repeat and repeat. Just keep doing that. Oh, but I keep failing. And you will till you die. Okay? You will never have a time in your life where you fixed it all and you won't have any more struggles. That is not going to happen. Be at peace with that. What you're going to do, though, is continuously pass the Deuteronomy 8:2 test. You're going to demonstrate in your heart that you're not happy when you mess up, that you want to do it right. That's all he's testing, is the heart. So, when you beat yourself up, you're looking. That's actually like taking the easy way out. Because basically you're trying to find an excuse to quit. Well, I just can't do it, so I just might as well quit. That's kind of the next thing. I'm not trying to mock the person. But that's where you're headed. Well, I can't do it, so I might as well quit. What's the point? Well, the point is that you're showing your heart. The point is not whether or not you fix it permanently. The fact is that he wants to see that you are going to never quit struggling against it. That's the key. Show him that you will not quit in your fight against it. All right, next point.
All right, Cynthia Morris. Is it possible to have a spirit mind even before one comes to Torah? The complete truth. This is referencing Romans 8, 7 through 10.
You can, in your culture, you can, in your upbringing, have caught on to some of the things that are of the spirit. Like almost every culture says murder is not acceptable. That's a law that most flesh has. Most flesh is against stealing. Most flesh is against a lot of things that are of Torah. So, no, it's not that way. The spirit mindset is when you come into the full understanding of Emunah, that there's a creator, he has rules, he expects you to follow them. If you do, he's willing to give you everything. Eternal life, peace, wipe away every tear. See, that comes from understanding that there is an above, and the above wants to bestow on you all of these things and tells you how to receive them. Okay? So, yes, could you have had some of these things before you came into this? You did by default because you were raised. You know, I was raised by pretty good parents who taught me a fairly good idea of right and wrong, societally as we understand it, which almost all of it matches up with Torah. Now, it didn't have things like my parents should have known better, but they didn't. We ate unclean and we didn't keep Shabbat and whatever. But I'm just saying but generally I was taught to treat people correctly according to Torah. Generally I was taught, you know, not to do most of the Ten Commandments. I was taught not to steal or commit adultery or to bear false witness or, you know, I was taught, you know, murder. All these things I was taught. But that's not about the above mindset. That's a culturally infused mindset. However, our culture has in it a lot of Yah's mindset in it. Over the history of the world, we've come to recognize that people function better with these rules in place. And so almost every country has a good chunk of the Ten Commandments in their rules. I mean, it's against almost every country's rules to commit adultery and to steal and to murder and to bear false witness. I mean, those couple of things right there are generally illegal. Okay? Go ahead.
All right, this is from Nadia. Can Rabbi please expand more on the meaning of Numbers 14:18? Did it only apply to them back then, or does it still apply to us now?
Okay, so now I'm going to have to do that by interpreting what you're trying to say. Okay, so Numbers, that it says, Yahweh's patient, a great kindness, forgiving crookedness and transgression, but by no means leaving unpunished, visiting the crookedness of the fathers unto the third and fourth generation. Okay, I'm going to guess that this is more about the whole third and fourth generation thing. I think we all know that today we still have the idea of patience and kindness and forgiveness. And so, yes, this still happens today. But it happens today in terms of not so much punishment like you would think, but in imitated behavior. He's going to allow that behavior to be imitated, which is going to bring punishment and cursing on third and fourth generations. And then he's going to maybe hopefully inspire or spark somebody on that fourth or fifth or sixth generation to stand up and say, okay, this stops with me. You see this with lots of culturally and generationally passed down cursings, alcoholism and other abuses that are imitated from the parent and then from the grandparent. And you see, you know, if your father was an alcoholic, guess what? His father was probably an alcoholic. Guess what? His father was probably an alcoholic. You know what I'm saying? It tends to be that kind of a... And so it's cursing generationally till somebody stops it. And guess what? Their father wasn't. And the next one's father wasn't. And the next one's father wasn't. Whatever that was. Physical abuse. You've got fathers or parents that beat up their children. Guess what they're going to do to their children? They're going to beat up their children. Next generation, they're going to beat up their children. And so this applies, but not the way people think. They want to think of it from an outside source that he's just going to punish. Yes and no, indirectly more, okay? Because remember, there's also things like in Ezekiel 18, okay, where he talks about basically you are responsible for you. If your father was a sinner and you do what's right, you're going to be okay. Your father did what's right and you do what's wrong, you're not going to be okay. So when you read those kind of things, it helps you have context for these kind of things. So the cursing that goes to the third and fourth generation is because he's going to allow that to happen and keep going forward before he inspires somebody to wake up and make a stand. Does that make sense? Okay. All right, next question.
There's some CJ. Can we find good authority in a Christian church? Question mark. Here in the Netherlands, there are no churches like M2I. They keep Sunday as Sabbath and teaches no Torah. Or do I need to submit to that authority and try to change it from the inside out?
No, to both questions. Okay? There is no good authority that you're going to find in a wrong structure. Now, it doesn't mean that you can't find authority that tries its best to be benevolent and to care about its people and give correction, etc. But they're all basing it in a wrong framework. Okay? And so the fuel that feeds that is a wrong, you know, is errant. It's tainted. Your best option is to find a way to virtually be within this structure or a structure like this, like lots of the people right now online are doing. They're making themselves available to, and they're taking full advantage of the structure virtually that's available. I mean, I've counseled somebody just the other day from another country using Zoom with a 6-hour time difference or so, and we scheduled some time, and I got to counsel them online, you know. Okay? So this is something that is doable virtually. It's not ideal. But it's better than going into a place that you already know is going to potentially influence you incorrectly. It's kind of like I had a friend whose child was going to the Adventist Church's schools. And I said, you do understand that your daughter is going to come out of there an Adventist if you don't watch it. Because the immersion in it is going to affect the way you think. You start going to any church, it will influence you at some point, to some degree, because you're immersed in it when you go on a regular basis. And so you can't get where you're trying to get by doing that. Okay, you're not going to get there. All right, next question. And we'll take maybe one or two more here.
There's probably that much more left.
Okay, good.
Gene Havoc, I am trying to understand what you mean by authority and leadership. Could you be more concise? Would you consider yourself a judge, a priest, or a teacher, or something else?
Okay, we've covered this on a lot of teachings, but I'll answer for you here. Look, I consider myself, well, it really doesn't even matter what I consider myself. What you guys would consider, look at the fivefold ministry in Ephesians chapter 4 that Paul talks about, okay? I wear a lot of those hats at various times, okay? When I'm doing a lot of the things that we're talking about in like the teaching on the Sabbath or the holy days or the different laws and stuff, I'm in the role of teacher. This is what you need to do. This is how you do it. This is when you do it. This is where you do it. This is why you do it, etc. Teaching like today, which is trying to motivate you in your doing, is more of the prophet role. You've been taught, but you need someone to get in your face a little bit and tell you, hey, this is important. You need to do it. Okay? Or you need to, this thing here, you need to stop doing it. So I'm not claiming to be whatever title anything is. It's not about that. It's not a pride or ego. I'm a prophet. I'm a teacher. It's a role that you function in. Now, as far as leadership, this is where you have to look for that anointing of the person who's been called to be a head over hundreds or thousands or whatever it is, and has that shepherding responsibility to keep everybody safe, to keep them out of the ditch. If they fall in the ditch, they go pull them out. And so it's something you recognize functionally. It's not something that you need someone to just tell you, here's my title and here's the thing. MTOI is a structure. It's an organization that's built with structure. So you can see that's there. It has leadership. It has people in positions of authority. It has people that have chosen to be submitted under that authority and others that are attending, who are checking it out, who haven't really made their minds up what they want to do with that. And that's okay either way. But it's something that you recognize. I can take everybody in this room here and sit them at that piano, and guess what? Some of them will be able to play a little bit. Some of them won't be able to play at all. Some of them play very well. And you'll be able to recognize the talent of playing piano in that person, okay? On the other hand, the same thing is with leadership. People can stand up in front of a mic. People can do all kinds of things. You either recognize that the person has that particular talent or they don't. We call it an anointing, okay? That's a real fancy sort of spiritually sounding word for they've got the gift and the talent of it, All right? Just like singing. Ever watch American Idol? You heard a lot of people, they sing really well. A lot of people can't sing at all, but they think they can sing. We got a lot of people out there who can't lead very well, but they think they can lead. Who makes the decision? The audience. Okay? You who come into structure can figure out if there's real leadership there and how that works. Just like if you listen to someone sing, you'll know if they can sing or not. Actually, it's amazing how few people actually can know because they don't have the ears for it, but it is quite astounding. But see, actually, that's a really good example. If you don't have an ear for it, if you don't know what to listen for, you may think someone has talent who doesn't. Same thing with leadership. If you don't know what to look for in leadership, you may think somebody's a great leader when they're not, or someone's a terrible leader when they are a good leader. But are you actually qualified for that? I'll give you an example. I'll use my wife for the example. You know, when we actually started off years ago, we caught American Idol, which is a, you know, we thought it was a singing show. We like to listen to people sing. And I have an ear that's trained to hear, you know, when people miss a note or miss something. And so every now and then the singer would miss a note and I'd be like, oof. And she'd be like, what? I said, you didn't hear that? And she'd be like, no. And then as I taught her to develop the ear, then later on in further seasons, somebody would miss a note. She goes, they just missed, didn't they? I go, yep. She learned what to listen for, you see? Not that she didn't have the ability before, but she didn't know what to look for. See, a lot of you are in leadership, and you don't know what you're looking for. So you don't know if it's good or bad. You think it's good, it might be bad. You think it's bad, it might be good. You don't know. And so that's the kind of thing that you want to also do, is come to the place where you know what to look for. See, if you're listening to someone sing, do you know how to evaluate someone singing? Okay? I've told my daughter when she plays, I said, every now and then you're going to miss a note, but you know what? Almost nobody's going to notice except maybe three people in this room. So don't worry about it because they don't know what to listen for. They won't know that you missed. So don't make the face like Manny today on the drums when you missed and you made the face. Okay? But nobody else would have noticed. All right? But you make the face. Yeah. All right? Okay? You went to change that Tom riff, right? And you didn't, and you missed. Right? Okay? So that's what I'm talking about, but nobody else is going to notice, so you can't show them that. But the thing is, are you, when it comes to leadership, let's bring it back to where it started, right? Do you have the understanding of what makes a good leader? Do you know what to look for? And if you don't, you need to figure that out. Otherwise, how are you ever going to know if you have a good leader? All right, good question. Next question.
That's a good question. I got someone's got a comment here. I'm just read out. The Milburgers. Thank you, Rabbi, for every Sabbath. God reveals to us through you how much more purging and retraining of our hearts, minds, and souls we need from Christianity to living Torah. Your words are purifying.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
That's infinite questions.
That was it?
That's it.
All right, good. And we're just about at 5 o'clock. We had a nice, easy, early day.